The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And can you hear okay, everybody? Good. I am in the mood today to take your questions. So, I'd like to hear your questions. Once, many years ago, when we were teaching in Palo Alto, I did that. I said, I showed up and I said, I would like to hear your questions. And then someone asked a question. And then any other questions? Someone else asked a question. Any other questions? Someone else asked a question. And we spent the evening, I didn't answer any questions. We just had people saying their questions. It was a great evening. It was really something very profound. I think really beautiful happened, listening to people's questions, heartfelt questions. Something deeper and deeper happened as we just had the questions stated. I'm not proposing to do that today, but good. But I'd like to have you start rather than me. I guess I have, but... any questions about practice, Buddhism, anything you'd like to ask? And realizing that none of you were prepared for that, we can sit here and wait until something bubbles up. It's said in Buddhism that you make very good merit if you ask questions.
Question about forgetting things. And I've noticed that in the effort of trying to simplify my life and slow down, I have had these lapses of, like, I can't believe I forgot to do, like, today I forgot to go to jury duty, just completely. and this is, like, a string. I've had, like, a string of these things, and maybe it's not Buddhism, but... I guess I've been wondering, like, is this, like, a side effect of trying to slow down?
And if you were speeded up and multitasking, doing many different things, then you would have remembered?
Maybe just the sort of touch and go. Maybe if I were like a little more caffeinated or something, that I'd be chewing all these things over, and I don't know. Have you noticed that before in your practice or in other people's practice that?
I haven't noticed it particularly an issue for me connected to practice, but other people have talked about that as well, but not something as dramatic as missing jury duty. But I don't know, you know, about you, but what's interesting is to consider how much of memory, remembering something, can sometimes be fueled or engaged in out of fear or out of greed or desire. And so some people are hypervigilant and they maybe even do many things, but they're always, something's not quite right. I have to take care of something here. What is it I have to take care of? And so they don't forget because they're always asking that question. And when they finally relax, take it easy, and that hypervigilance is no longer there, they might not have that extra oomph to remember. And sometimes they might be more forgetful as a result of that. I mean, there certainly are innate differences in people's capacity to remember, to memorize, remember things. So if that's the case, and you don't have, if without fear or without greed or desire or some other thing, caffeine to keep you going, you don't remember things very well, and then you got to set up systems so that you get reminded. you know, big post-it notes on your front door. Anything it takes. So, but the interesting thing, the interesting question, I think, for me is to explore, to what degree is your remembering things fueled by attachment to something, to fear or to desire? Do you recognize that in yourself at all? Or, you know, what motivates you to remember? And then, of course, there's also the human, wonderful human capacity of avoidance. And sometimes the not remembering is something inside of us doesn't want to remember. There's a resistance there, and something shuts down. So that's something else to explore. You know, my son often doesn't remember. Specializes in it. So someone else. Yes.
I have a question about retreats. This is such a huge part of this tradition, is for people to go on retreats. And my life is in such a way that I can't go on any retreat. And I feel, well, can I do it even without it? I mean, I feel real concerned about that.
It's a great question. Great concern to have. So those of you who might not know much about our tradition, particular tradition that we have, came to the United States as a retreat tradition. And the first teachers who taught this tradition came teaching long, intensive retreats. And then slowly, that was in the kind of mid-70s, and then slowly over the last 35 years, it's expanded out, and it was maybe in the mid-80s that there was a first kind of community meditation center. Ours here at IMC was like the second one in the year 2001 or so, 2002. and so slowly, as the community of practitioners has matured, there's been a greater understanding of the importance of practicing in daily life as well, not just practicing on retreats. And some people have really specialized in developing their practice at work, in family life, in social life. And so Andrea Fella here at IMC, for example, she teaches this householder's retreat that allows people to go to work and do many things, but allows them to explore the practice in daily life practice as opposed to retreat practice, and explore it in a deeper way. So there's been kind of a growing, expanding outwards understanding there's much more to the practice than going on retreat. But still, the idea that since we're a meditation tradition, the idea of being able to meditate in an in-depth, longer way on retreat still remains often held up as an ideal, because it's such a wonderful place to really deepen one's meditation practice, really simplify one's life, and discover something different about how our minds and our hearts that you can't really discover if you're busy doing a lot of things. So it's a beautiful thing to do. So what do you do if you can't go and retreat? You're left out of the benefits of this practice. And there are people, I know, especially in the 1980s, that there are people who felt a real sense of pain, feeling they were left out of what was kind of being offered as the real juice, the real benefits of the practice. But I think that feeling, some people still feel that, but that's has diminished quite a bit, because there's such a rich array of offerings of other ways of practicing now in our tradition. And also there's a much richer understanding of all the different ways that the human being develops spiritually. And it used to be that 30 years ago there was like only meditation was the way. But now there's a sense that as important as that is, it might be more important the breadth of character development that happens in daily life practice. So there's tremendous value in cultivating ethics, in personal integrity, tremendous effort, a benefit in cultivating a greater spirit and attitude of generosity, service, and honesty and truthfulness and right speech, in loving kindness and compassion, and wisdom, and you know, many things. There's, you can develop all these different qualities. And so those things can sometimes better develop in daily life. And also, among some teachers, at least, is also an appreciation that there's a kind of a mystery, perhaps, or an unknown quality in how different people develop their own inner life. Some people's inner life develops best on retreats. Some people's inner life or spiritual life develops best outside of retreats. You know, both maybe are important, but some people find the greatest benefit by practicing daily life. Some people find the greatest benefit being on retreat. Just different kind of people. And then the mysterious part, the unknown part, is that there might be some, you know, karmic or personal kind of qualities that mean that certain way of practicing is more important than others for certain individuals. And so who knows what route you need, any person needs to take, what people are working through. Some people find that what's really important for them is to have family, and that allows something to be complete, something to work through something, and that's a path for them. Someone else is going into a career is a very important thing. For other people, it might be a distraction from spiritual practice to be caught up in, you know, family affairs forever and ever. I mean, there's no end. And so, you know, especially if you start having many, many kids and you start, you know, what are your priorities? Or you have a career and you want to get to the pinnacle of that career. You know, what's the trade-off? And I think any mature life has to understand there are trade-offs in the different choices we make, of choices between worthwhile things. And so what are the trade-offs? And what are priorities? And what are we willing to sacrifice? People who are not willing to let go of worthwhile things so they can really excel in other things won't excel. And so there's a whole grappling, sometimes wrestling, inner wrestling needs to go on in a life like this about what's really most important for us and how do we simplify the great array of possible things we can pursue. And I've been very inspired by the people I've met who have made a very simple life their priority. Not to live a simple life, but so they can really plunge deeply into a meditative life or spiritual life, really kind of stay close to it and develop it a lot. Some people have complex lives, and who knows, maybe something very important is working itself, discovering, kind of something needs to clarify itself in that life. And only when things have been clarified are they ready to put it down. So who knows what a person needs and what, you know, what you need. Only you can say that. So you what I hear in your question is that you'd like to go further in your practice, but the tradition says go and retreat, and you can't do that. So how do you go further? So there's, you know, I'd say two general things. One is that something that I feel very almost passionate about is that it can be expressed in the idea that no moment of mindfulness is ever wasted. And there's something actually very powerful, powerfully meaningful about being present this moment. If you can really kind of find yourself into this moment, regardless of where you are, with kids, with grandkids, and a busy life, doing many things, and really find how to be present fully in that, without clinging, without resistance, without being for or against, just really there for that, fully engaged in that activity, that's meaningful in a very profound way in and of itself. Nothing's needed beyond that. The idea of spiritual attainments beyond that, down the road, are just ideas. And if you really feel how their ideas, thoughts, as opposed to the vibrancy of being here and now, they won't have their such a power over you. So that's one thing, is to really appreciate how wonderful it is here. And I have known people who discovered that on their deathbed. You know, it'd be nice if they discovered it earlier. But it's quite significant even then. And they realize nothing needs to happen. And they're really here, this moment. And there's something radiant and peacefully about people sometimes. So that's one answer, is just really appreciate the practice you do and really do the moment-to-moment practice, and to appreciate something, there's something very profound to appreciate in the moment-to-moment mindfulness. And can you find that magic, or find the key of what, just this simple moment of mindfulness, how valuable that is. The second thing is that there is growth and development over time. And so, more than just being mindful and present. So how can you best grow and develop? So I would look at the life that you have, reflect carefully. This really has to be the way you think it has to be. Have you really done the analysis properly? And you might actually share your analysis of your priorities and what you're doing with a number of good friends, and hear yourself speak it, why you make the choices you're making, and get some feedback from them to really make sure that you've made the right choices. I know that I've sometimes thought I was doing the right thing, and all kinds of rationale. I thought it kind of intuitively felt right, but then when I spoke it out to someone, I realized, wait a minute, I don't know if that makes sense. So you might explore it that way. But then also, as you understand your life more fully, then see, ask questions like, what areas of this life that I live can I grow in an inner life? Can I become more pure, more grow? So for example, if you spend time with other people, can you cultivate greater patience? Can you cultivate greater honesty? Honesty is something that shouldn't be under... Many of you probably think you're quite honest. I think you're quite honest, I'm sure. But, can you be more honest? I had a conversation with someone recently, and she said something about wanting to come to some event that I was, some social event, that a friend of mine who's come to a social event, that I didn't really want her to come to. You know, I like my friend, I care for her a lot, but it's just kind of complicated. Her to come, but I got kind of tongue-tied about saying that. I should have just said it. I'd rather you didn't come. But I got kind of tongue-tied, and because I got tongue-tied, it kind of put a damper in my mood for the next kind of 5 minutes in the conversation. I felt kind of held back. She said, at some point she said something to me, Gil, you've gotten kind of serious. So I could have been more honest. You know, it would have been much easier for everybody. Could be more honest. So explore that. There could be, is there a room in a busy, complicated life to cultivate more loving kindness? I wouldn't underestimate the tremendous power of developing a kind heart and a caring heart. And so exploring loving kindness, what does that mean? Taking care of, you know, grandchildren and friends and this and that, or taking care of yourself. Like sometimes I'll walk down the street or I'm in the supermarket and I'll practice loving kindness kind of practice in a kind of creative way where I just see people, strangers, and I don't stare at them. I try to make it so they don't notice. May you be happy. Sometimes I don't even say the phrases. It's kind of like this act of imagination or I wish them well. You know, it's a nice thing to do and it's certainly better than some of the alternatives my mind can do. And so I think there's no shortage of opportunities in your life. And so rather than going on retreat, perhaps there's some way of turning up the inner juice, the inner pressure on yourself, the inner motivation to engage in your everyday life in a deeper, fuller, more committed way. That's a long answer, I apologize.
Gil, I feel that the practice has been good, and I've come to a certain point, and it's either a plateau or a barrier to what I would imagine is the growth that you talk about. And so, you know, it's peaceful, it's regenerative, it feels good, and so on the way in, notices said, hey, Vipassana meditation starts with the breath, look at your body, we say a few things like, may I be happy. By the way, when I say may I be happy, sometimes I get jolted. What do you mean, may I be happy? But that's a sidebar. So there's Vipassana meditation. Are there other forms, other techniques? I like variety. I feel a little stuck, Gil, in my meditation practice.
There is variety. Then we do stuck meditation.
Stuck, yeah. Would you explain that to me? That's a good one.
So then you turn your attention and carefully you're mindful of stuckness. How do you feel stuck? In what way you're stuck? What are the beliefs around stuck? What are the feelings around stuck? Who is it that's stuck? It's very interesting to look and say, who is it stuck here? You might be very surprised what you discover if you ask that question well. And it's a whole world, interesting world. And you explore, you stay present for stuck until it either resolves itself or dissolves itself. And then what? So it's worthwhile. And it's an important thing to say to you, because, or to anyone, because when people feel stuck and they switch to another practice, they lose an opportunity to understand something. And they'll do that practice until they get stuck. And then they'll go to something else. And all spiritual practices have to fail sooner or later. It's really important that they fail. Maybe they only begin when you fail in them. So the fact that they fail, the fact that you're not having trouble, is not necessarily a bad thing. It's not the time to meet, let's go find the, down the street they have, another way. Because this didn't work for me. If you come to the situation where it doesn't work, then you should pat yourself on the back and say, finally, now I can start. I don't have a clue how, but... So sometimes we need to hang in there when it gets difficult. Having said that, to answer your question more directly, what you asked, there are many practices in Buddhism. If you limit ourselves just to Buddhism, there are many, many different kinds of meditation practices. Even within Vipassana meditation, there are different forms of Vipassana practice. So you mentioned, starting with your breath and your body. That's one way, with the breath at the center. There's body scans you can do. You can do walking meditation, walking mindfulness. You could forget about the body and the breath and just a mindfulness of the mind. What goes on in the mind, the attitude, the quality of the mind. Just notice that, what the movements of the mind. Just notice that really carefully. Some people find that very interesting. It's possible to do loving-kindness practice. It's possible to do contemplation practices, contemplate peace, contemplate virtue, contemplate the teachings of something. You can contemplate death. It's considered one of the great practices, is to have contemplation of death and dying. And you can sit here and just say the word death in a quiet, meditative way and see what bubbles up for you, what comes up. It's like a little catalyst you drop in and something starts happening. Or you could, there's a tradition in Buddhism where you go find a corpse. Usually nowadays people go find photographs. When I was in Thailand, some of the monks I met would have, they get these gruesome photographs of people who are in car accidents, dead people, and they're colorful, and they'd have it on their wall of their little hut because they were doing death contemplation to remind themselves of death. That'll wake you up. That'll give you something to work with. That's interesting. And if you feel stuck then, then that's really good. And so then there's also, there's so many, there's a great variety of things to do. There's forgiveness meditation you could do. Some people are stuck because they're stuck interpersonally, and so they need to do some forgiveness, loving kindness.
Analytical person, and so whenever I think about some of the things you're saying that I might try that, I might try that. I catch myself saying, oh yeah, but you're thinking much too much about this. In other words, I confuse the concentration and all. I immediately, my mind starts thinking, analyzing, and then I kind of say, well, that's not working.
Great.
So maybe I have too much of a thing about the stop your mind from thinking. Maybe that, could you talk about that?
I will. Happy to, because what you described is a common for many people. Not everyone, but it's a common enough phenomenon. And there's a lot to be said about it, so I'll say a few things. Hopefully, some of it will come across. One is, when you notice that you're doing something that seems unproductive in meditation, be very careful to notice your relationship to that attitude. So like for you, maybe if you start getting analytical, that's what your mind does, it gets analytical. What do you put on top of that? Do you get angry with yourself for being that way? You judge it saying, oh, this is bad, I'm never going to get into the spiritual life, I'm always going to be analytical. Do you add you know, some burdensome thinking on top of it? And see if you can, and then if you notice you're doing that, see if you can let the burdensome thinking drop away and just recognize that you're being analytical. And you can't get concentrated in the breath because you're getting analytical, but make it very matter of fact, very simple for yourself. Oh, this is what's going on. And one of the reasons to do that is that allows you then to do analytical meditation for you, which means, here what it means, is that you turn around and actually feel your way, sense your way, look your way into what it's like for you to be analytical. Not so much the engineering of it, not so much kind of the how you do it in terms of the steps of being analytical, but what's the feeling, the emotional tone, what's the emotional fuel for being analytical? Is there tension anywhere in your system? Is there fear? Is there desire for something? What's going on in you? Because if it's a big part of your life, you want to get underneath the surface of it to understand what's really going on, what's that like for you? Because then you can settle it. But if you don't turn and look at it and study it in a quiet, mindful way, feel your way into it in a mindful way, it's going to stay operating and churning away. It's probably a deeply ingrained habit by this time. And so it's going to kind of begin, you know, it's just always going to be there kind of, you know, hounding you. So I would be very, try to get as calm as you can, as kind as you can, and turn around and just look at that mind that's always analytical. Almost as if you were looking at a stranger talking a foreign language. And you're looking and feeling you can sense through the tone of the voice the emotions that are being expressed, you know, the concern the person has, and what's going on more deeply. Does that make sense?
Like your what's going on. I'll walk away with that tonight. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm finding that during meditation, I'm doing it about 25 minutes every day in the morning and things, and I'm finding that in terms of the mindfulness, I find myself all of a sudden, it's like, oh, I'm back. I mean, it's kind of like...
Outside of meditation?
No, I mean, I'm just sort of, my mind kind of takes me away somewhere. I mean, I'm catching it, but it's not like I'm kind of sitting out watching kind of thoughts come in. It's like literally something is taking me off onto, I've gotten onto the train without, you know, being aware that I was on it. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, okay, come back, breathe, you know, get back into the breath.
Right.
And I'm not really sure if there's something to the fact that it's just, it just kind of has plucked me up and taken me out, or if just trying to figure out really where that's coming from, or if that's
great. That's exactly what you should do. I can't tell you. I'm not going to tell you. But I think that interest and curiosity, you know, what's going on with this mind of mine? You know, that's part of what the value of this practice is to be curious, interested, fascinated, disturbed, if you like. You know, wow, this mind, it has a mind of its own. and uh, And let me try to understand it. Let me listen to it deeply, like I'm listening to a friend who's, you know, really needs a good friend to listen to. Let's find out what goes on there. What goes on when mind, you know, jumps out and gets lost on that train? And it might be hard to kind of see, but if you're interested in that, and kind of try to stay a little bit alert, when you do notice you've been on a train for a while, don't go back to the breath right away. Just stay on the train for a little while. And just kind of listen like you're listening to a friend or someone speaking a foreign language or something. Just listen to yourself being on that train. What is it like? What does it feel like? In real time, right here and now, what's it like to be on this particular train? What's the tone of the voice? What's the how fast am I thinking these thoughts? What's the emotions under them? Kind of get to know what's going on there, because chances are that whatever it is that plucked you out of the present moment and put you on that train is still operating when you're on the train. So if you linger on the train for a little while to understand, you'll start understanding better what's going on. And what we're doing here, you know, this kind of practice is a radical re-education of the mind. It's a radical understanding of how the mind or the heart operates and works. We see it. So and if we see more clearly, then there can be this revolution in the mind of living and operating a different way. We turn it around. But I think that what you asked, that's a great question, and I commend you for it and that interest. And I think it's really my job is to encourage you to keep that question and try to find the answer for yourself. You look disappointed. You look disappointed. No?
I have a follow-up question to his. So I really like the answer that you gave him, and I try to do that. And I try to do it not just when my mind is on the train or when my mind is on a thought, but I'm multitasking and I breathe in and I think that little thought and then I'm back on my breath. But the thing that's really fascinating to me, though, is following that train of thought of, you know, what is this distraction like when I'm nodding off? Because when I nod off, I'm going forward, and then I come back, and there's this momentary shock of, you know, of falling over and then coming back. And so it's very difficult for me to go back to, okay, what was that like?
Uh-huh.
So I've done it enough so that I'm like in slow motion coming back, but I can't quite touch that thing of what's it like to be nodding off, like, because of that. I think it's because of that little jolt that still is there.
Yeah, so certainly that's an interesting practice to study it, to look, be mindful of that process and look more carefully. But it sounds like you've done it for a while. It sounds like you've done it long enough. And with nodding off and being, you know, that kind of nodding off and sleepy, perhaps it's much more useful, productive, not to investigate it anymore and keep nodding off, but actually to get some chi going. You know, sit up straight, you know, kind of sit up straight, really kind of try to get some energy going, and let's try, rather than the route of a deeper understanding, it's the route of, this is the time to awake some energy here. Open your eyes, sit up straighter. Your turn.
I don't know if this is the same answer you might have given earlier, but one of my big barriers is the shoulds. I'm the first born to an immigrant Catholic family, and I'm a female on top of that, so the shoulds have been very, very heavy in my life. And so one of the things I've loved about the practice here that's done me so much good is that it's not so shouldy. No, thou shalt and thou shalt not. But I know that I've reached a point where I could and should.
Where you what? You could
where I
should
could
now.
And should go further with my practice. But then I hit that you're should and I have
you're
aversion
mature.
To that.
Oh, you. Oh, I see.
You know, so that I should meditate more. I should, but then like. I'm so ruled by shoulds everywhere else. And
So it might be more interesting for you to try to, maybe it's interesting to, in terms of meditation at least, I don't know about the rest of your life, but to change the word from should to want. And what happens if instead of saying I should meditate, you say I want to meditate? What happens then for you? Right now, internally, what happens when you shift it like that?
I think about all the other shoulds I need to put aside in order to do that.
I see. Because so is your Achilles heel your sense of responsibility? Yeah. You go to the grave. There'll be your epitaph. She was a responsible person.
She took care of everybody.
We shouldn't banish the word "should" from the English language. It's an appropriate word. But it's also, a lot of people are terribly oppressed by it as well. And so some people feel very liberated when they say, don't should. You're just going to free yourself of it. But anytime you want to accomplish something and it has a requirement, something it requires something of you to accomplish it or require to do it, it should, right? In order to do that, I should do X. If I want to pee, I should go to the toilet. That's what we say at IMC, at least. I don't know about anywhere else, but here that's what we like. We have a carpet. And it's an appropriate word at times. But you might want to start by asking yourself, what do you most want? And when you do all the shouldings that you do, what's the want that's behind there? And is it a want that you really want to live by?
My question is around applying the teachings and the principles of the Eightfold Path or just teachings of communication in relationship with someone else where there's a commitment to doing the practice. And so when it comes up in moments of, well, here's an issue that's come up, how would this be handled in a mindful way? Or the whole idea of what is the practice, what is mindfulness, and then the concept of when there's a commitment, but sometimes it almost becomes an argument about the principles themselves.
A commitment to the Eightfold Path or commitment to the relationship?
Well, everything. Definitely
commitment
to the relationship.
Commitment to everything.
Well, and just if you've heard anything about in partnership, whether it's with family or friends or a significant other, when people are aware of the teachings, and then it becomes a conversation about, well, here's an opportunity to practice that. I'm just trying to find out if you've heard of any kinds of ideas that helps people to become aware, wait, here we're actually trying to practice principles.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand, so I apologize if I don't quite understand, but what I'm remembering is after I was a teacher for a few years, Buddhist teacher and all that, I would come home to home to my wife, and we would talk about something, and sometimes she would look at me and say, "Gil, you're using that voice again." the teaching voice, and that didn't work at home. It seems to work here okay sometimes, but it doesn't really work at home. Dear, let me tell you about the Eightfold Path.
Direction. Definitely.
Yeah. So, it's certainly valuable and very precious if you have a relationship with someone where you can talk about practice and your understanding, your grapplings, and your exploration of practice. You have that in common. That's nice. But I think that if you're doing the Eightfold Path, you should probably operate as a first principle, as a first approach, that you're doing it privately. That you're not, no one needs to know that you're doing it. And if they're kind of engaging you or you're kind of talking about, what's going on, you don't say, well, the third step of the Eightfold Path is right speech, and I'm trying to write speech, and we have these different categories of right speech and what's wrong speech, and let me go check the scriptures. wait a minute. You know, and you should also be, you know, Buddhist, and you should all. I mean, that's just a headache. It's not appropriate. You should internalize these things enough so you can they're your own, so that no one knows you're doing the third step of the Eightfold Path. You say, you know, it's really important for me to have kind speech, and I'm trying to figure out how to be kind here, or it's really important for me to speak honestly. And that's what I'm grappling with and trying to find out how to have this honest conversation with you. They don't have to know that you're practicing the Eightfold Path. Because then you're kind of doing your trip on them, and you bring this kind of heavy spiritual authority, authoritarianism. You know, in Buddhism is great world religion, the Eightfold Path, you know, it's kind of this weight. That's fine for you privately, but spare your friends.
I'm not really talking about that. It's more where there is a deep commitment and a deep practice with someone else, and
both of you share the
correct,
same.
Correct. And the idea comes up: what is wise? We use the term wise versus right. So what's wise speech?
Then you're lucky. You're fantastic. So have conversations, explore it, talk about it.
But then sometimes there can be an argument about even practicing the principles themselves. And that's where I go, how does this happen? How can the principles ever be argued about, at least talking about them? So I find myself having resentments because I had an expectation about something.
But then you've forgotten the first principle. It all begins with the Four Noble Truths. So if you're suffering, and if you're angry, then you're suffering, then your first responsibility is to look and understand the suffering. You know, what am I clinging to here? Take responsibility. If you're frustrated and getting angry, you're not taking responsibility for something. So I would forget about, you know, what the true definition of right speech is and who has the right definition of right speech or what, you know. I would take a step back and, dear, I'm suffering. And can we stop talking about wise speech right now? And can we instead kind of have an exploration of, you know, what might be going on here that I'm caught in frustration? So if there's suffering is like, you know, someone, you know, Cheryl made this beautiful bumper sticker for us. Remember a bumper sticker that she had that said, I stop for suffering. So, you know. And if you have a really good kind of practice partner who's willing to practice with you, give them the permission to stop you. Dear, you seem to be suffering. Could we stop? Could we kind of take a pause in the conversation and kind of step back and look at what's going on here? It's fun. Thank you very much for your questions and for everyone else who's listening. I hope that the rest of you who are listening, hearing the questions people had and also hearing the call for questions might have prompted you to kind of stretch that part of your mind to maybe think of questions or move in that direction. Having questions is a really useful way of developing Buddhist practice. And you can kind of expand. The practice expands, grows, matures, deepens, whatever you like, in part by your capacity to ask questions and to go through your life, you know, asking, what's going on here? What is this really? How is this done? You know, and so whether you can go on retreat or not, you'll find your life deepens the better the questions you ask. So thank you all very much.